I went to the doctor on my own, and I'll never forget him saying to me, "Oh, Lindley, there's not one baby, there's three." I decided three things. Number one, I was going to be a hands-on mum as well as have a successful career. Number two, as a sole breadwinner, I was going to need to earn good money to support us to have a decent lifestyle. And number three, staying healthy, sustaining my energy and having good work-life balance was absolutely going to have to be a priority.
How do you define peak performance, and when you're going into companies and doing the change management piece and training up the leadership, what are you finding is working really well to get the most out of people without pushing them to the absolute brink of exhaustion and burnout?
Being a good role model, particularly on the health and well-being side and the work-life balance side, is absolutely crucial that that's modelled at that senior level and that they actually believe it, not just play lip service to it.
Lindley, welcome to the Career Confidence Podcast today. I am really honoured and excited to have you on. The conversation we're about to have, I know, is going to be full of value, especially in today's climate and what's going on in our society right now. Before we go into the nuts, the bolts and all the strategies and all the things we're going to talk about today, let's set the scene. I'd love to know more about yourself, your career journey, and what motivated you and inspired you to start your coaching business, Peak Performance. So, Lindley, over to you.
Thank you, Georgie. And it is a real pleasure to be here. And as you alluded to, I'm the co-founder and the CEO of Peak Performance International. And we're a people and culture consultancy based in Melbourne. And we specialise in culture transformation, customised training and development. And more, this next phase of my career is focused on executive coaching. So like most people, I certainly had an interesting career journey in the beginning. But it certainly did help to set me up for success in my own business. And you might be able to tell by my accent that I grew up in Auckland in New Zealand. And when I left school, like most kids, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. In fact, right up until the last week before I was supposed to start, I was heading down the path of being a school teacher. And then unexpectedly, I got into a computer studies course. And I say unexpectedly because we had to do a whole lot of, aptitude tests. And I had no clue. I had no idea about computers. And I was really surprised to even consider that I might have had the aptitude. And they took the first 10%. So apparently that was good. But I must say that, you know, that was back in the days of the mini computers and mainframes and all the rest of it. And I decided to do that course because it was shorter and I knew that the industry was better paid. So that's how I got started in the IT sector. And I did really well at the things like, I think it was communications, English, systems, analysis, anything to do with people. But the reality was I was really a hopeless programmer. And I hated it. Those back in the days with the punch cards, you had to punch them out. And if you dropped them or made a mistake, you had to start again. And I finished the course, but it made me think, I'm never going into the computer industry. And that was that. So first false start. So the other thing that I was good at school was biology. So I thought I'd try healthcare. So my first proper job after completing that course was as a neurophysiology technician at Auckland Hospital. And that was doing tests on the muscles and the brain. And funnily enough, it's almost come full circle with neuroscience and neurocoaching and all that sort of thing. But again, you know, most of the time I was doing EEGs, putting electrodes on people's heads and all of that sort of stuff, looking for abnormalities. And I just did not like the environment of being in a hospital. It was dark, it was no sunlight, everybody was sick. So again, not my thing. Another false start. And then I had a couple of jobs on the fringe of the computer industry. And anyway, eventually I found my way to a pre-sales job in the computer company. And finally, I realized that I'd actually found my niche. So I guess the lesson there is, you know, you can start on one thing and who knows where you're actually going to end up. But the really important thing is, I know that you would attest to, Georgie, is really finding that fit, what's right for you, your personality, what you're good at, what you don't like, all the rest of it. So the next 10 years of my career, I guess, was racing up the ladder, making up for lost time, racing up that corporate ladder in computer companies. And I was very fortunate to work for a couple of multinational IT companies. Some of you will remember Compaq, which was a very successful PC company taken over by HP. And then I was marketing manager at Oracle. And that taught me a lot about multinational companies and how they worked. It was fast-paced, high growth, and there was a really extravagant time in the tech sector. Money was, you know, no object. So I studied hard, working for my degree part-time. I had a lot of fun, those sorts of things. And then biological clock started ticking, didn't it? So after having my first child, I really wanted more flexibility, and that wasn't really available in the corporate sector in those days. So what I did after a lot of thought was I started my own marketing IT consultancy, working with smaller companies that didn't have the IT expertise that I could actually bring. And that went really well. I learned a lot about selling. I learned a lot about small businesses, the challenges that they face, and it reinforced that I could be really successful in my own business, and it reinforced that I was not going to go back to the corporate world if I could help it. So a few years down the track, I found myself pregnant again and hoping to give our son a little sister. And after, I think it was about 13 weeks, I went to the doctor on my own and I had my first ultrasound. And I'll never forget him saying to me, "Oh, Lindley, there's not one baby, there's three."
Oh, my God.
So I knew it was going to be a high-risk pregnancy and I needed to look after myself. And it soon dawned on me that all going well, we would have four children under four.
Wow.
And that life would never be the same again. So once I got used to the idea of having triplets, I decided three things. Number one, I was going to be a hands-on mum as well as have a successful career. Number two, as a sole breadwinner, I was going to need to earn good money to support us to have a decent lifestyle. And number three, staying healthy, sustaining my energy, and having good work-life balance was absolutely going to have to be a priority. So then I took action and I started to create the life I wanted. And then when the triplets were just 3 months old, former colleague and I, Deborah, from Oracle, we founded Peak Performance International, and we're celebrating our 25th birthday in 2024.
That is such an incredible story. Thank you so much for sharing. Like, there was actually so much in that, but there's a few things that I personally just took away when you were speaking. One, thank goodness technology has evolved, because otherwise I don't think I would have a job and be recruiting anyone into technology. So I'm very grateful for that. Secondly, I love the fact that you weren't afraid to try different things and experiment. And I think that, you know, if I reflect on my own career journey, I was the same, but so many people go, this is the degree I've got to stick in this. And if I sway away, then I'm, you know, what was it all for? It was a waste of time, a waste of money. Not the case at all. I think you're right. You've got to sort of understand yourself, your values, and what you want out of your career. And then obviously the whole parenting, you know, you set a goal, you decided that you want to be a hands-on mum, you wanted to have, you know, so much power to you, earn your own money, support your family. Like, that was incredibly inspiring. And then the 25 years of you and your co-founder with Peak Performance. So incredible, incredible story. So much to unpack there. But what I would really love to sort of dive into now is your journey of building peak performance, because 25 years in business, is that something to absolutely celebrate? Like, congratulations. Like, when you sort of see the stats, most businesses, unfortunately, most small businesses, you know, most of them go out of business within 4 years. And the fact that you're still in business after 25 years, you must be doing something right. So talk to me about what you actually do in terms of, like, you know, you speak about going in and really sort of helping businesses, cultures, and sort of how the idea came about. I'd love to sort of go back to the start about where it all began.
Okay, well, I was doing my marketing consultancy work, and I realized that, you know, the consulting model, time equals money, was just not going to be sustainable. And we had decided that my husband was going to be the house dad. So I was going to be the one that had to bring in the money. So in my mind, I had, okay, I have to have a proper business, if you like. And interestingly, when I started at Oracle, when looking at the numbers, it was really clear that there was one side of the business that was really profitable and it had a lot of growth potential. And training was often an afterthought when, you know, selling databases and applications and things like that. It wasn't even included in the proposal half the time. But what we noticed was actually the training side of things was very key to a successful implementation. And that side of the business had been neglected because no one really understood it. And I was new on the leadership team. So I was given the job, the hospital pass, if you like. I was given to me to fix it. And I soon realized that the study that I was doing in marketing, I think I was still studying at that point, maybe not, maybe I'd finish. But I realized that training in marketing isn't that different. It's really all about communication, engagement, and influencing people to take action. So my colleague at the time, Deborah, she was lead trainer at Oracle, and together we started to make education more visible. We put some marketing strategies in place, and guess what? All of a sudden, it took off, and it became a really successful business unit that went under the consulting part of the business. But what that did do is it helped Deborah and I to learn, actually, that we worked together really well as a team. And we knew that although there was a lot of technical training available in corporates, the research that we'd done, and of course the people that we knew, we realised that there was not a lot else out there in terms of sales, particularly customer service, which is a big topic at the time, and leadership. So we thought that there was a bit of a gap there. So it was a few years later that we decided to get together. Like, I was doing my marketing consulting, she was still at Oracle. And then we thought, okay, well, the time is right. And that was literally 3 months after the triplets were born. And we were really fortunate. We partnered with an author and a business consultant called Dr. Ian Brooks. And he'd written a book called Second to None, Six Strategies for Creating Superior Customer Value. And I knew someone who knew someone who knew him. And anyway, we got together and we ended up creating a training program around that content, because customer value, as I mentioned, customer value as opposed to customer service, was a really hot topic. And it just really took off. So we ended up working with some of New Zealand's leading companies like Telecom in New Zealand, Fisher & Paykel, Bank of New Zealand. And the work that was done that we did at Bank of New Zealand was noticed by their parent company, National Australia Bank. So what happened was we ended up getting quite a big contract training about 3,000 of their business bankers in about 2004 or something like that, 2003. And that was really the start to our business taking off, not just in New Zealand, but we took the opportunity. So again, Georgie, you talk about, you know, having to take some risks. We took some risks. We got a team of people, team of facilitators up and running here in Australia. We knew nothing about Australia. You know, the people at the National Australia Bank, they thought, what, who are these women? You know, what are they doing here? These little old New Zealanders, what would they know? So it wasn't easy. And anyway, that ended up being a success. I ended up moving over to Melbourne to expand the business in 2004. Deborah came to Brisbane in 2005. And it was a difficult couple of years really getting started here in a new country where nobody knew us. But by 2006, we started to get a few clients, and one of the fantastic clients that we worked with for several years was Bendigo Bank. So once we sort of had a few big clients, then we were away. And as they say, the rest is history. So that's sort of how we got from the beginning to Australia, and then those subsequent years. We've been working with a wide range of clients in a whole range of different sectors, really big clients, banks and finance and telcos, all of that sort of thing. We've been really lucky. And more of late, particularly around the culture survey and the culture transformation, some smaller companies, when I say smaller, that they tend to be part like professional services or something like that. And it's really incredible working with those companies because you can see from end to end, you can really see the difference that you make, and you can work one-on-one with the leaders a lot more easily. And I've found that I've really loved doing that side of things. And the other thing, Georgie, I've noticed is that in all those years of working with leaders in corporate, so many of them are working so hard, they're working so long, they're under so much pressure that it's really impacting their health and well-being and their personal lives. And that's really why I'm dedicating this next phase of my career to working with leaders in that situation to really help them to sustain their success and at work and in their personal life. And that's what's really giving me my buzz these days and where I'm really focused on taking my business.
I definitely want to go down that path because I from speaking to a lot of people in the C-suite right now, there is a lot of pressure, there is a lot of stress, and I really want to sort of pick your brain on sort of how you're going about sort of helping these people. But I just want to actually just take it back, because what I'm so fascinated by in your journey is how you did all this with three young children. I know you had your husband there for support, but I want to just sort of like just sit with that for a second, because I think that is just so, that's just so inspiring for especially women to hear that you are a walking, talking example of what you can do when you back yourself, when you believe with yourself, when you surround yourself with obviously the right people. You're not afraid to take a few risks, but there were so many reasons for you not to do it. Like, you've just been told that you're having triplets, you've got a young family, you know, more reason why to go and get a steady job and stay where you are and, you know, keep on earning more money that way. But you just backed yourself and went for it. But during that time of building Peak Performance, having a young family, were there, how did you go about that? That before we sort of go on to talk about how you now coach leaders to do that, but how did you go about finding the balance? And because I think one key thing that I hear a lot from speaking to a lot of women is striking that balance and moving away from the whole mum guilt piece. But yeah, I'm so curious in like how you sort of blend and balance both. And did you do it well? Did you, you know, like what was your experience like?
Yeah, well, I think because I had one child and then figured out that, hey, you know what? It looks like I can be successful in my own business. I'd already taken that risk. So for me, I knew that. And I'm not saying I never thought about going back into the corporate world, because I did. And even, you know, over the years of Peak Performance, there have been times when I thought, gosh, this is hard. Maybe there's an easier way. And I've really thought about it. And then I've always come back to, do you know what? I really love what I do. I love the clients that I'm working with. And yes, it's hard at the moment, but that too shall pass. But, you know, getting back to your question about the family side of it, we have to have support. So it wasn't just me doing it on my own. It was a team effort. And I used to say, I get the easy job. I get to go to work. And, you know, my husband, he's home with four kids. And we did, in the beginning, we had night nannies. We had someone mainly looking after the triplets. We had Mike's mum. Like, you know, I had support around me. That's absolutely essential because you cannot do it alone. And I think one of the key things is just figuring out what is most important to you. And for me, I didn't want to be working and never seeing the kids. So I actually worked from home right from the start. And that was, you know, 25 years ago, more than. So that flexibility was key. So I think in terms of that is figuring out what's most important. And actually a different phase in my career now, like all of our children have now left home. And we were thinking of moving up to Queensland because we had a fabulous time up there in 2021, the second lockdown we managed to avoid from Melbourne. Then I had to think about, okay, well, what are my core values? And one of my real core values is family. So again, it was going back to those core values and saying, well, if I make that decision, I'm not going to see my family. They say they'll come up and visit, but of course you talk to people and they never do. So it's just an example of keeping your values front of mind and then designing the life that you want. And you know, I think that's really key, but it's being clear on what you want. And a lot of people don't actually ever take that time out and think, okay, step back. I'm in this situation, but what do I really want? And what action can I take to get there? And it might not happen overnight. It might be part of the 5-year plan or whatever. But it is consciously figuring out what you want and taking action to get there.
I'm with you so 100% on that, because I think part of the problem in our society, and I can speak from my own experience here, is that I can recognize and pinpoint when I was going through a really bad bout of anxiety. I've spoken about a lot about that on the podcast, but I was so far from my values, Lindley. Like, one of my values is health and growth, right? So let's just take health for an example. I was working long hours in the corporate space. I had no time for me, no time to, you know, really to just do much exercise, no time for mental, emotional, like nothing. And I was actually becoming really quite unhealthy. And that was then causing me anxiety, causing me to feel really out of balance, because I was so far away from my sort of core values, which is health and well-being and really making sure that I'm looking after myself. I just certainly didn't have the time because I was prioritizing work and money and finance. And I almost sort of lost myself in that process a bit. And I think it's just so important, whether you're starting a business, whether you're in your career, whatever it is in your personal life, to know your core values, because you will be led by that. And if you, you know, sort of drift off, you then can sort of really start to, I think that's where the balance gets out of whack. And that's where a lot of mental health problems come into play. So if you say my core value is family, yet you only get to spend an hour a day with your family because you're getting home from work late, dropping them off daycare, whatever, you're going to start to feel something's not quite right. And we maybe can't pinpoint it, but it's, I think, because we are moving very far away from what's truly important to us.
Oh, you're so right. And your story is a very common one. I hear that all the time. The health and well-being, people start neglecting. That's one of the first thing that goes. And the self-care aspect of that. And I think it's really interesting. I had a coaching conversation not so long ago, and we were talking about all sorts of things. And then I asked my client, so what do you want? And she went quiet, and I thought, oh, I wasn't sure what was going on. And then she came back and she said to me, you know what? I don't remember the last time anyone asked me that. And I really don't know what to say. Like, she couldn't articulate in that moment because it had been so long since she had actually thought about, well, what do I want in this situation? What, you know, what's important to me? And I do think that that happens a lot as well. We just go on autopilot. We just do what we think we need to do. And then it comes a time when our health and well-being starts to suffer. And then if we don't listen, then our body stops and makes us listen. We burn out or whatever. And it's really just important to listen and to think about what's important to you. Because if you don't, if you're the one that's responsible for your life, and if you don't think about what's important to you, if you don't take action to do that, nobody else will. So I really encourage people to do that. And there's lots of tools around for doing that. And you know, it doesn't have to be a really big thing. Even journaling or just asking yourself that question, what do I want? What's really important to me? And there might be a trade-off. Like for me, when I left the corporate world, you know, we had our ups and downs financially. It wasn't all just, you know, running out and getting a fantastic, building a fantastic business and had the income that I had when I was at Oracle. But that was okay. I was prepared, like, and my husband being the house dad, so many times we thought, okay, well, if he goes back to work, that'll mean more money. And then we looked at, okay, well, if you've got to pay after school, you know, before school care for four kids and buses and blah, 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 actually, is it going to be any better for us? And are the children going to be any better off or worse off? And so you think about those things and you make your trade-offs, but it's a conscious decision. And that's the key thing, not just getting caught up in it. It's making conscious decisions based on what's important to you.
You're absolutely right. And I think that a lot of people go through life without asking these questions and wake up one day and go, oh, how did I get here? What's going on here? You know, like, why am I unhealthy? Why am I not happy? And it's just really important to check in with ourselves. But I'm also very conscious of the current economic climate that we are living in right now. Like, and as I said to you before we jumped on the podcast today, like what I'm sensing in, you know, people that I'm friends with, friends of friends, just the general market, just speaking to candidates on a day-to-day basis, people are stressed. And I read actually on your website that, is it 41% of leaders are stressed and 36 are exhausted? That is such a high percentage. And I bet you now going into the rest of this year and the start of 2024, it's going to be higher. I just honestly think, I don't know many people that have said to me, 2023 has been a great year. Like, I don't think I've met anyone that said that. I think most people have gone, I've survived this year, not thrived. So I'd love to sort of pick your brain now, Lindley, like what you're seeing and what advice you're giving to leaders and executives and people in, you know, in their careers that really feel absolutely exhausted. They are stressed. They've got money, you know, money problems. They're thinking, how am I going to afford my mortgage? You know, how am I going to, you know, give my kids a good school holidays? What advice would you have for those people who are struggling, stressed and exhausted right now?
Well, what I see a lot is exactly what you're talking about. I mean, people are overworked, they're overloaded, and they're overwhelmed. And it's not just work. I mean, obviously being overworked, a lot of people are working very long hours, they're attending endless meetings, they've got different time zones, all of that sort of thing. And I see two camps actually with the flexibility side of things. For some, it's an absolute godsend. And for others, it's meant that there's no boundaries, that they are constantly on and they just don't have that break between work and home. So it's actually causing even more stress. So I don't know, where do you fit on that one, Georgie? What are you hearing around the flexibility side of things?
I'm hearing that people want the flexibility. That's what I'm hearing from a lot of people that I'm working with from that sort of hiring perspective. But I agree with you that there needs to be boundaries, because what I think is also happening, especially for like the women that I'm working with, is that they're then sort of doing more of the housework, they're doing more of the cooking, they're doing more of the childcare. And these, and I read somewhere that women work like an extra 20 hours a week unpaid. And that's basically all of the house chores, the kids stuff. So there does need to be some boundaries. but I think also the corporates are under pressure as well, because they've got targets to meet. They've not probably had the best year in business. So it's just almost like everybody's just stressed and everyone's sort of like trying to sort of figure it out. So I think people are finding it hard to push back and have boundaries, because some people are just grateful to have a job right now, because there's been a lot of layoffs this year. So it's very interesting. I think a blend of hybrid working is perfect. I think the idea of having a couple of days from home and a few days in the office is very healthy. I personally find that works really well for me. But yeah, I think if you are working from home fully remote, having those boundaries and those clear communication is very, very important.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm certainly being someone who's been remotely working for years. I think it's absolutely key. And I do think what you're talking about there about being overloaded, it's not just about being at work and working really hard. As you say, many of us are juggling so many different commitments. We're juggling work and family and community and other personal commitments and responsibilities. And we're really struggling to stay on top of things and feeling exhausted. And when you look at feeling, if you're overworked and you're overloaded, then that's when you start to feel overwhelmed. And sometimes just turning on the news in the morning is really, really overwhelming. And when you're feeling overwhelmed, that's when you start to feel some of the pressure around, you know, difficulty concentrating. Maybe you've got experiencing anxiety, headaches, stomach aches, lack of interest in things that you used to enjoy, not really being able to recharge. And what I find is when you're feeling like this, it's really important to stop and take notice, because it's not sustainable. Something's got to give or you will burn out. So I guess that's really my message. It's like, number one is take care of yourself first. And there is a reason why they say put your own mask on first when you're in an aeroplane, because if you're not taking care of yourself, maybe not immediately, but definitely in the end, you won't be able to take care of others in your life. And many of us are so busy taking care of our partner, our children, maybe our parents, our team, our pets, our boss, our siblings, our community, et cetera, et cetera. And we're wondering why we're exhausted. So the thing about self-care is, I know for some people, they feel that it's really selfish. And for others, they feel that it's a bit of a sign of weakness, especially men. But self-first and self-care is definitely not selfish. It's absolutely essential. And we know that's been selfless and self-last. It's just not sustainable. So it's about finding ways, and sometimes it's 5 minutes, it's half an hour, it's an hour in your day, in your week, to do something that's specifically for you to help you to recharge your batteries and to take care of yourself, because it will come back and bite you if you don't. So that's my number one.
Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. I wanted to quickly pop in and talk to you about our amazing supporter, CH Talent Solutions. We are an IT and digital recruitment company based in Australia. If you are someone right now looking for a new opportunity or considering a career pivot, please reach out to one of our consultants. Or if you are somebody looking to build your team or build your company or scale, again, please reach out to us if you are looking to find the best tech talent fast. I look forward to connecting with you. Now back to today's episode. Enjoy. No, I completely agree. And just on that note as well, I'm actually really grateful that I went through that bout of anxiety in my 20s, because I ignored all of those signs. I ignored the exhaustion. I was just like, go, 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 go. And it's almost like to overcome it, I just worked more. I was like, oh, what's this feeling? I'll just work more. I'll work more. I'll work more. And actually what that did was just completely throw me into exhaustion. And then I started getting tight chested, panic attacks, and it just spiraled out of control. But now, because I know I've gone through that and I never want to go through that ever again, if I find myself getting a bit like, I don't know. It's just like you just said there, lack of focus, fuzzy headed, not feeling as like motivated when I wake up, like these subtle little things, you know, a bit more snappy, a bit less patient. I go, oh, something's off. And I just identify it immediately and take action, not just go, oh, just, you know, I'll go to the movies over the weekend and recharge or open a bottle of wine. I actually just sit with that and understand what is actually going on. What am I focusing on? Why am I feeling like this? Oh yeah, that's right. I haven't slept very well for a few nights now. Right. Maybe I need to start prioritizing my sleep again. So there's just a few warning signs that I can identify now, because I went through something quite extreme in my 20s. So I'm almost grateful that I've got that. But for those that maybe they're just used to feeling exhausted all the time, maybe it's just they think that's the norm, but it's not. Any other practices that you think work really well with, like when you're dealing with your clients, Lynley, that you always recommend?
Well, I think we've touched on one of them, Georgie. That's the prioritizing what's most important. Mm. So figuring that out, and making sure that you do make choices, because we do have choices. We might think that we don't, but actually we do. So making sure that you align with your core values, your goals, and your responsibilities. I think that's one thing. And one of the other things is what I call making your own rules. And again, I find quite often we operate on autopilot. We're convinced that everything we do is absolutely essential and that it's expected. But sometimes that's just not true, and that's just old habits getting in the way. So I encourage people to really challenge their own rules and challenge their own norms, and to perhaps set new boundaries about how they work and live their life. And it's, you know, sometimes it's when do you start doing your emails in the morning? When do you close your laptop at night? It could be at home. Like I've got one client who was telling me, you know, I've decided that I'm going to stop doing things that nobody cares about at home. What's it? Quiet quitting. You know, quiet quitting at home. So she's just stopping doing certain things. And she said, well, my husband hasn't even noticed. So more power to her. So, and that sort of also lines up with simplifying your life, because again, often we've got so many things on the go, and particularly if you have children. And I think that COVID taught us one thing, is that the children don't necessarily need to have all of these extracurricular activities that help have us running left, right and centre. So it's looking at things that do cause you stress. Sometimes it might be people that are causing you stress, decluttering, cutting back on commitments, writing your not-to-do list, and making sure that you put that into play, stepping back from certain people who cause drama and things like that. So simplifying your life. And last but not least is probably managing your energy as well as you manage your time. So we all know how important time management is and how that can help, but really managing your energy is absolutely key. And you've already touched on some of the, you know, the conventional things, like making sure you get good sleep, your diet, your exercise, all those sorts of things that we all know about. But also to look at some, perhaps some complementary wellbeing practices, and that can really help you to maintain optimum energy. So I think that that's really important as well.
I know it's really interesting, like all the books on time management, but ultimately, if you don't have the energy to give to the task, then it doesn't matter about the time management. If you're exhausted and lacking in, you know, focus, and you're fuzzy headed, you're not feeling great, you know, you can have all the time in the world, that task is just not getting done to the best of your ability. So you're so right about managing your energy more so than what you manage your time. But look, I'd love to sort of touch upon now, like when you say peak performance, to me, that sort of means, and it means something very different to me now than what it would have done sort of like 5-10 years ago. But to me now, what that sort of means to me is the ability to operate at my absolute best mentally, physically, emotionally, and to feel like I'm getting good outcomes without the expense of my health and well-being. So how do you define peak performance? And when you're going into companies and doing all of the change management piece and training up the leadership, like What are you finding is working really well to get the most out of people without pushing them to the absolute brink of exhaustion and burnout?
I think you've actually said it quite well, Georgie. From when we started 25 plus years ago, it's become a lot more holistic. In the early days, it was, you know, it's all about performance, you know, high performance culture. We've got it. And that meant, you know, fast paced, doing everything to the best, and making sure that we most importantly do well financially. So it was very, very hard hitting. And, but that wasn't necessarily the way it was for us and what we brought. And we actually found that the clients that we worked well with had a real people focus. So in regards to peak performance, it is more about the people side of it. We do look at the purpose, people and process side of it, if you like. But it is more holistic and looking at getting that balance right between a culture of well-being and caring, if you like, and the high performance aspect of it. So it's making sure that you're looking after your people, because if you look after your people, of course, they look after your clients. And if your clients are well looked after, you're going to have a successful business. So it's bringing all of that together and actually figuring out, well, what does peak performance look like for our organization? What does it look like for our leadership team? What does it look like for our individuals? And really focusing on that, because there's not one size fits all. It's about making it right and making it work for your organization and your people.
Do you find it all stems down from the leadership team as well? Like, do you think like they have to be bought in first? Like they have to be emotionally intelligent? Like what does the future leader look like? I think that's changed a lot as well.
I think, Georgie, your point about emotional intelligence is really key. And that's been around for a long time. I remember, you know, 20 years ago, it was Daniel Goleman, et cetera. And it really, again, has become full circle. And actually did accreditation in a tool called ECR just recently. And it really brought home to me how important that is. And in fact, when we look at building peak performing cultures, one of the key things we look at is the emotional culture. And that's, how do you want your people to feel when they're at work? How do you not want them to feel? And then what does that actually look like? How does that play out in the day-to-day? So it is bringing that emotional culture as well as the, you know, the intellectual culture, if you like, into play. And most definitely, it starts at the top. It starts with the CEO, the leadership team. And I think being a good role model, particularly on the health and well-being side and the work-life balance side of things, is absolutely crucial that that's modelled at that senior level and that they actually believe it, not just play lip service to it.
Mm-hmm. You're so right. And I was smiling as you were speaking there. It's got to be role model, because I've worked for organisations where the leaders would boast about being in the office at 7 o'clock, you know, staying until 9 o'clock. And, you know, if you walked in the office at 8:30, it was like, which was actually the start time. Well, this is late. Where have you been? No, oh, how lying today. Yeah, correct. Right. And if you left before 5:30, it was, where are you off so early in the morning? Like that type of culture. And it was actually so toxic. And I stayed there for 18 months. And I think that's actually where my anxiety began, because the pressure that I felt, but it all stemmed down from the leadership team, and everybody else was just petrified. But what was really interesting when I reflect is that they ended up with such a high turnover of people. No one was happy. And actually, people just literally sit at their desk and look around to see who was going to leave first. But they weren't doing any work. They were sat on YouTube, Facebook, like literally just literally being busy for busy sake. And I think this is unfortunately still the culture in some organizations where, you know, it's busy as a badge of honor. And there's a difference between being busy and actually being productive. So, and you said something really powerful. You said, you know, about sort of like decluttering your life and thinking like there's so much clutter in our lives, in our mind, in our careers and everything. How would you sort of like advise a company that maybe has identified, we've got a little bit of this toxic culture, we really want to set our people up for success? What advice would you have if they have had this sort of like toxic culture of, you know, driving hard numbers, KPIs, you know, just how can they sort of untangle that but get more out of their people in a more holistic and supportive way as opposed to just burning them into the ground?
Yeah, well, I'm somewhat biased here, but I would say, you know, the first thing that you've got to do is you've got to have an objective culture survey. You really have to understand where you are, what the culture, what your people are telling you. Because, you know, we've seen it that they might recognize that there's a toxic culture, but they think it's because of something, you know, something that's absolutely, when you look into the data, is irrelevant. So often we find that there's a disconnect with what the CEO and the leadership team think and to what their people are experiencing. And that research that you alluded to from Deloitte's at the beginning that we talked about, that did highlight that there's quite a difference. And we do find that in our culture surveys. So it's really, really important to actually get your baseline measure of where are we at. And then once they've got that, and we get that by doing a culture survey, an online culture survey. We happen to use Barrett Analytics, but there are a number of them. And as well as getting that the quantitative data, you've got to get the qualitative stuff. So then you take that and you might do some focus groups and really dig into, well, what does this mean? How does this play out in our behaviors on a day-to-day basis? And then your people will tell you everything you need to know to fix your toxic culture if you would only listen. So then it's about getting the data from all the different sources and then determining, well, what is the culture that we want? What does the peak performance culture or the optimal culture or the whatever culture you want to call it, what does that look like for us? And then you consciously start to design that. So you go through a process with the leadership team and you look at behavioral norms, you look at, you know, your values and your purpose and all, you know, all of those things and figure out, actually identify it, actually encapsulate that so that you can communicate it. Then you prioritize, okay, well, what are we going to do? What are the first three things that we're going to be able to do to actually move the dial, move us to where we need to be and start putting things into place. So as I said, it really is getting your baseline measure, putting some things in place purposefully, designing what it is that you want and that you're working towards, and then putting some measures in place and track and measure how you're going. Because again, what we find is they'll start the process and it's too hard. So they'll do a culture study, and then they won't do another one for 5 years until the next CEO comes in, partly because they're too scared to see what's not happened to remeasure. So for some companies, but the ones that keep on to it, it's not something that you just throw a culture survey in every now and then. It's something that you just have to maintain. Your culture is something that's so important that you've got to keep working on it. It's not something for the HR director. It's not their problem. It's everybody's opportunity. So you've got to measure, track and measure how you're going.
Mm-hmm. And I think what companies need to understand, and this is me coming at it from a recruitment lens now as well, is that people have got options. And one of the first questions that myself and my team get asked when we're hiring is, we speak to candidates all day, every day, and they say, what's the culture like? What's the team like? What's the leadership like? Like, they are so interested in, it's not how much am I going to get paid? It's, what's the company culture and what are the company values? People are asking these questions, especially the younger generation coming up. They want to know, like, what, you know, what is, you know, is it a sustainable company? You know, what are the values? Where is it going? What's the mission? What's the vision? They are very purpose driven, the next generation coming up. They're not just about getting a pay slip and spending at the pub. They want to feel like what they're doing, how they're coming to work every day matters. And you, if you honestly want to be in business in 10, 20 years time, these are the questions that you need to be asking yourself from day one. And obviously, if you're a big organization, it's hard to change it. But, you know, if you're a small to mid-sized business and you want to grow over the next 10, 20 years, it's so important to get it right. And I think the culture survey to start with, or just getting a pulse of where you're at, is definitely the first step, because if you start to become aware of things that aren't quite working, you can quickly change it and you can be nimble. So you are at an advantage there.
And you can also focus on the strengths. And that's a real key thing as well, because there will be really positive things in your culture that you want to protect and you want to strengthen. So it's not all about finding the bad stuff. It's finding what's working for us, what is core to who we are, that we will protect and that we will want to continue within our culture. And you made a really good point about being able to make the connection between the purpose of the organization and what each individual does and how they contribute to that. And I'm reminded of a story with one of our clients. They were in the telco sector, actually, and they had a massive project that a lot of the organization was busy delivering on. It was really big, really visible, checking in with the board all the time, and it was an industry-wide thing. And there was a team in IT who were just beavering away, doing their thing, and they felt disconnected because here's all these people doing this wonderful stuff for this big project, and here's us just doing our job. And we're having a focus group, and one of the guys said to me, he said, you know, it was really fantastic when my boss made the connection for how we were contributing to that big goal, that big outcome, because without us keeping doing what we were doing on an everyday basis, we couldn't keep the lights on. It was like we kept the business running while everybody else was doing their thing. And they ended up being really proud of that. So it's like, as a leader, what you say is so important, particularly with the younger generation, but being able to make those connections for people, because sometimes it's not obvious in some of the roles that people have, and really making sure that people are aware of that and they feel that they are contributing.
Yeah, you're so right. And just giving praise as well. I think businesses are so quick to pull people up on things that they're not doing well, but they're not quick enough to reinforce good behavior. And I think that's what needs to be focused upon in organizations, is that great job. And like, the people are just so quick to go, oh no, that was not good. And people start to get deflated. So we just need to reinforce good behavior and, of course, pull up when things don't go to plan. But it's also having a culture of, you know, rewarding great behavior and collaboration and communication. And that's ultimately what I see are the best workplaces. And they're the ones that I want to recruit for, because people go in and stay and are really set up for success. And especially now working with a lot more women who are sort of asking me, where's good places to work? Where can I really go just be set up for success? Who's got good cultures of inclusivity and not just like, you know, a tagline, where actually is a really good place to work? These are the questions that I ask now when I start working with someone from a recruitment perspective, like, you know, what are your values? What kind of culture do you have? And, you know, you can see it straight away. And you know what, as well, it's a feeling. I think culture, you're so right. What you said is you walk into a reception area, and I'm very observant. I look around and I go, are people smiling? Are they chatting? Or they sort of sat with headphones on looking miserable in a cubicle? Like, I'm very aware of what's going on. Do you and I know you're sort of nodding your head, so I know you get it.
Yes, like you can tell the minute you walk into a place. And you can tell when you start talking to the leaders as well. You can tell whether it's just lip service or whether they really do care. So, you know, in your role, Georgie, it must be really interesting trying to sort of dig beneath the surface and just actually understand what's really happening, not what they say is happening. It's absolutely a feeling around the place, and you can definitely tell, and I think that's a really key thing that I'm sure you do. Not so many people are in the office these days, but most definitely to be walking around the office and seeing what's going on and how people are interacting is really a key indicator of the culture.
100%. Lindley, I could sit here and honestly have a chat with you about culture, performance, everything. You know, how long have we got? But I want to sort of end on, you know, we're going into, you know, obviously a brand new year. What would you sort of like to see happen in terms of, like, from your business perspective? Like, you also mentioned that you're really focusing on the well-being and how important that's going to be. And I think that's going to be an ongoing conversation in most organizations. But what are your goals and vision with peak performance over the next sort of year and beyond? What would you like to see? What would you like to bring to organizations?
Well, I'm really focused now at this stage in my career. I'm very fortunate to be in a position where I can focus on the things that I love to do. And what I love to do is the culture surveys, because that really does help organisations to bring their people together, and it has a huge impact if they do it well, if they do the survey. And then, of course, the key thing is to actually get them to implement some things. Sometimes that doesn't happen. But I think culture has never been more important, and the well-being aspect, bringing that more holistic well-being aspect into the conversation, making it part of the core culture, not just an add-on that we have a well-being officer or HR's now going to put some stuff in place and we have some yoga lessons and things like that. It's about really making it core for who they are. And then it becomes actually a competitive edge. What you're talking about, Georgie, it helps them to recruit and keep their key people. So for me, that's really important. That's sort of where I'm going and sort of where I'm steering the culture piece. And of course, a key component out of that, and what I've discovered that I really love, is working one-on-one with the leaders, and probably mid-level leaders who are struggling, who are often just hanging on by a thread. When you sort of dig a little bit deeper, they're successful on the outside, but not necessarily feeling it on the inside. And the danger is that those people burn out. So I guess one of my key things is I'm on a bit of a mission to help those sort of people avoid burning out, like be preventive. I want to help them to sustain their success, their hard-earned success that they've worked, their career that they've worked so hard for, to actually help them to sustain that. Because when you think about it, how many more years are you going to be working? Is it 5 years, 10 years? Could be 20 years, could be more for some people. So you've got to be able to sustain that. So that's my thing. It's all about helping leaders to achieve sustainable success at work and in life, which I think is the key thing, is the whole holistic thing around success.
1,000,000%. And just final note on that, what is, if you have like one piece of advice to give to the people that you just described there, those that are hanging on by a thread, stress, like, is there something, that one tangible thing that they could start doing today that could have an impact on their lives and their careers?
Yeah, I think get some help and support if you need it. And that could be a counsellor, that could be a coach, whatever, but recognise that you're not alone and there is help. But I think I would go back to the number one thing that we talked about before, which is self-care. I would encourage everybody to just be more aware about taking care of themselves so that they can take care of others in their life, and to find some things that really work for them, and to make sure that they put themselves number one, make top of their list, not the bottom of their list, when it comes to their priorities.
Beautifully put. Lynley, I'm going to make sure that we put all of the links in the show notes so they can go and find out more about yourself, peak performance, and hopefully reach out to you and get that support. And if you're a company listening to this, get that culture survey, find out what's going on in your organization. But it's been an absolute honor speaking with you today, and let's get you back on in a year's time and see how you're going with all the leaders and helping them out and making sure they avoid burnout. So thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you've got this far, that honestly means the world to me and lets me know that you've got a lot of value from today's episode. So if I could just ask you to do one thing, pull out your phone and please leave a quick review. It honestly would mean the world to me. It will help this podcast grow and get our message out there to more people. So if you could do that for me, that would be amazing. And please reach out and just let me know what you want to hear more about, what you're interested in. It will just also help me make sure that I'm continuing to speak to topics that are relevant and also find guests that are real true experts in what you want to know more about. So have an amazing day. Thanks so much for doing that. And I can't wait to share the next episode with you. Thank you.